from the experience of samsara. Samsara, therefore, in this case, would be all the involvement in the external movement of consciousness. The dream state is the other side of the awakening state, he says. In the dream state, the unconscious is active and the conscious is inactive. We see the same relationship between the experience of life and the experience of death. Here we have a quotation from Evans Wentz, which is also quite useful, about the entire bardo. Rationally considered, each person's after-death experience, as the bardo todol teaching implies, are entirely dependent upon his or her own mental state, mental content. In other words, the after-death state is very much like a dream state. This is now the great translator and scholar Evans Wentz. And its dreams are the children of the mentality of the dreamer. This psychology scientifically explains why devout Christians, for example, have had visions in trance or dream state or in the after-death state of God the Father, seated on a throne in the New Jerusalem, the Son at his side, and all biblical scenery and the attributes of heaven, and so forth, because the framework into which the psychic energy is cast is the one that determines the imagery that comes forth. The Chikkai Bardo, which is the first one of the after-death Bardos, namely up there, is the one that one really needs to look at first. Elizabeth Kübler-Ross, whom you know is one of the important researchers into the experience of death and dying of the recent decades, in her book, in fact, entitled On Death and Dying, speaks of various stages of death. She says that the first several stages involve denial, anger, depression, and similar reactions. Then comes what she calls the fifth stage, which is the acceptance of the reality, the inevitability of death. This is, of course, within a person who is still moving towards death. In this stage, she says, there is usually awareness of the coming of death. And from this stage on, there are usually 3 or 4 days, hardly ever more than 7, until the person dies. This is, of course, not in cases of sudden and unexpected death, which incidentally, both in the East and in the West, let's say where there were, in those systems there is still a strong spiritual connection, was always regarded as a rather undesirable possibility. Now, of course, here again, the alienated kind of ego-oriented person, which is most of us most of the time in this culture, says a million times, whenever death comes up, oh, I hope when I die, I go just like that, you know. And I'm just going to, whatever, just, you know, very, very quickly. But if you look back into the Middle Ages or the Renaissance, or even now in some of the traditional ancient Christian systems, you will see that the sudden and the unprepared death is regarded as a calamity. From the sudden and unprepared death, good Lord, deliver us. Why is that? Because these people still had a connection with this dark side and said, if you are not prepared, you're not going to fare too well. This is an important event. You should be prepared. And so really what Kübler-Ross was talking about here too is a period of preparation, of moving toward the experience in certain stages. C.G. Jung, in his commentary on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is very interesting, he wrote a psychological commentary to Evans Wentz's work, writes, the supreme vision comes not at the end of the bardo, but right at the beginning, in the moment of death. What happens afterward is an ever-deepening descent into illusion and obstruction. down to the ultimate degradation of new physical life. This is Jung writing. Yeah. Well, that's what I like about the old boy. He had a real, really good Gnostic attitude toward these things. But you know, you have to remember what degrading means. It's taking you down so many notches. Like if you have a general who misbehaved and they rip his stars off and they bust him down to, I don't know, lieutenant or civilian or something, that is degrading. It means from a higher grade coming down to a lower. It's perfectly valid expression. And then Jung says, the spiritual climax is reached at the moment when life ends. Now, what we have therefore in the Bardo is the indication that once, according to the Tibetans, once the individual truly exits from the body, and that is not necessarily when it doesn't breathe any longer or the heart doesn't beat, because according to the Tibetans' beliefs, there is a more subtle withdrawal, for which reason, for a certain period of time, it varies somewhat according to which of the particular schools you are dealing with, but by our reckoning, about 3 days and nights, the soul, whatever might be called the vestigial selfhood of the individual, is said to be still there in or near the body. And therefore, the Tibetan lamas will think nothing of sitting by an apparently dead person within the period of those 3 days and nights and recite the bardo to him. They say, he can still hear us. He doesn't hear with the physical ear any longer, but he can still hear you up to that point. And after that, he goes. And then now they implore and instruct the dying or the dead individual to be very careful, be very clear-sighted, and concentrate very strongly and see the ultimate clear light of the Buddha nature up here. Try to get a good glimpse of it and then move toward it. And they say this is difficult. It is difficult primarily because the soul is sluggish. It doesn't realize that this truly can be done. And so it sees that ultimate light only as a distant vision, is not sufficiently affinitized to it. But if it's properly instructed and exerts itself at that point, it can. And believe it or not, the rationale behind this is that if the individual is able to move at that point toward, at the moment of death, toward that ultimate life, according to the Bardo, liberation ensues. Can go right out of the system at that point. There is an opening. You can go right out of it. And so again, it's a very different attitude. Western occultism and all of these isms that we have around and so forth, New Age, and in many, many ways, these are nothing but occultified Calvinism, you know? And you can see that by the tremendous emphasis on karma and things like that. See, the thing is, oh, well, you want to be liberated, you want to go to a higher state of heaven, or you want to see God or whatever the case may be. Well, you have to earn it, you know. You have to earn it. You have to be terribly good, and you by somebody's standards, you know, and you whatever you can't eat meat for 7 incarnations and everything else, you know. You have to have abjured even Annie Greenspring or some of the lowest alcohols, you know, and everything else, and then you will earn it that you can go up there. Earn, heck, you know, the Tibetan says, you have to know when the door is open. See? You have to know when the door is open and go for it and you'll slip through. Well, the Westerner has this kind of bookkeeper attitude. I have so many sins, I have so many virtues, I did so much good, and when that all balances, then maybe I can get something. No, you have to know when the door is open. It's a matter of skill rather than this business of spiritual accounting. In this case, the skill is to recognize the presence of that clear light. Now, I have to come a little bit to many of you that is familiar anyway, at least quite a few, but there is, quite independently of Tibetan Buddhism, and I was seriously doubted that there ever was any kind of contact whatsoever. I think if the Tibetan Buddhists and the Jewish Kabbalists had ever met, they would have probably mutually considered each other vile demons. So I don't think that they exchanged too much information. But let's say there is a model, a diagram, a kind of a mandala that exists in the Kabbalah. It's very, I'm certainly, I don't have the time to go into it to a great extent now. It's really very, very simple. It is the linkage that exists between the highest point of transcendence and the deepest or lowest point of immanence or embodiment. And in the in-between region, and there are envisioned 10 different powers in all of these. Now, the three highest powers, which in the Kabbalah called the supernals, and the apex of which called Keter, the crown, up there on top, the Keter, the crown, has a white light in the Kabbalah. It is the white light of transcendence. And it is above the abyss, and that is the transcendental of the divine world. Down here at the bottom is embodiment in Malkuth, in the kingdom. Now the Tibetan system would indicate that at the point of death, the individual consciousness, well, let's call it that, it's maybe a little better than calling it soul, the individual consciousness has a chance to go right up there and by way of that white light on the top exit the system and be liberated and join Buddhahood. It could be done. It is able to do that. If we can, then do that, then we have overcome. No more doing, no more becoming, no more riding on the wheel of birth and death, no more reincarnation. We are there, and we have exited. In this condition. There are three, in the Chikkha Bardo, which is what we are talking about, there are three phases of that as well. And the individual is made to face, they say, in three different directions. And first, he faces the past. And recognize what he or she has become. So as one dies, the past becomes apparent. And the results of that past, this is where we are. This is what we have become in this lifetime, or maybe as the result of previous lifetimes culminating in this one. Then, look up. You face the possibilities of the future. And then the third one is facing what we are, the clear light of the void. So there is the past, the possibilities of the future, which would involve other rebirths and so forth, and the clear light. And so the individual has to unite at this point what one has become, what one ought to become, sort of the ideals, and by way of this union, move into the clear light and be liberated. So that is the top point. I can't and I won't go into details at this point. But there are numerous forms of ecstatic experience induced or brought about by various means, meditation or otherwise. But this exactly holds true. We would envision that it's always a kind of a ladder-like ascent. So now I move from earth to, I don't know what the occultist calls the astral plane, and from that to the mental plane, and from that to the intuitional one, two, and then finally we get up to the real good stuff. But that is not really the way it works in these powerful altered states. Sort of the greatest energy is at the point of the change from physical consciousness to something else, in this case to death. And therefore the greatest opportunities for the highest kind of experiences are early in the game. Early in the game. Then depending on how well they say, how well you take advantage of that, you either remain there. That, of course, is not that possible while you're still in the body. That is only when you're out of it. Or you come back, you sort of sink back to an other region. And see, they say in most instances, simply because people don't know any better. The skill isn't there. The will that animates the skill isn't there. Intentionality and know-how isn't there. They go up into that light and then they sink back to the middle region. Yeah.
Would someone that has taken the bodhisattva vows, say, of the Buddhists, mm-hmm. would they be able to go up to the top of clear light for that definition of liberation, or must they go back down?
There is a different keynote, and you must remember Tibetan Buddhism is all Mahayana Buddhism, and the Bodhisattva the orientation toward the Bodhisattva idea is generally present, and they still advise this to be done. What happens is the Bodhisattva who really has become a Bodhisattva, this means someone who has voluntarily renounced the greater Nirvana in order to remain as a helper he still would do that. But then the re-embodiment would be voluntary and would occur under other auspices. And therefore it is much more useful. Such an individual has much greater control over choosing the body and the circumstances of birth than the one who just falls back down. So speaking of that, the next bardo is the Chanyit bardo, where the consciousness sort of sinks there, and as the result of not having been able to sufficiently unite with the white light. So as we might call the Chikai bardo, the highest one, sort of the spiritual reality, here we might see is psychic reality. And this is characterized by a tremendously powerful interaction and one might almost say a sort of fierce battle of the opposites. And to those who have a little comprehension of Kabbalah, of course, it's not very well drawn. These two principles, which are the apex of the two pillars in the Kabbalistic system, namely Gevura and Gedula, or Gevura and Hesed, are recognized as the biggest opposites on the Tree of Life. One is astrologically, one is Mars, and the other one is associated with Jupiter. And so these are the real highest and most intense manifestations of the opposite, the giving and receiving and so forth, the strong smiting right arm and the giving kindly other arm and so forth. Now, interestingly enough, the bardo says that now is the point where the individual gets caught up in the drama of the opposites. And so there are the peaceful and the wrathful deities. And the descriptions in the bardo go on, and they are, I don't know, like you read that, you think that these people swallowed a truck full of LSD or something. Because, unbelievable, colorful and powerful and imagery, the terrifying, terrifying gods, the terrifying beings with, you know, in auras of flame and with gaping jaws, with blood, these sort of vampire-like deities, the blood-drinking ones, that is how they are called. They are the blood-drinking ones, the brain-eating ones, you name it, all kinds of, on the one hand, and on the other hand, beautiful, alluring, gorgeous, beautiful deities, and the soul sort of I envision it like a kind of a pinball machine, you know, it's being thrown back and forth between these, and the task is not to yield to the terror that the wrathful, the angry, the terrifying, the vampire-like deities induce on the one hand, and not to yield to the lure of the beautiful ones. He says, if you allow yourself to be drawn into or onto those that are very beautiful, and if you run away from the ugly ones, then you're lost. Lost in the sense that you have to keep coming further down in incarnating. But if you are able to avoid the influence of the opposites and keep a totally balanced condition, unaffected by either of them, then, like in the Kabbalistic middle pillar, you still can go up. But it's very, very difficult. You're buffeted about by these opposites to a very great extent. Let's see that. I think there is a nice quotation somewhere here, gives you a little idea. This is again by our Chinese author, but it's very nicely done. He says, the knowledge-holding deities. See, there are